I'd just like to introduce my colleague here, my comrade, Pat Deutz, who is now going to give you a talk on Rosa Luxemburg.
Right. Sorry, right, Pat. Thank you. Right, good afternoon, everyone. Rosa Luxemburg. Now, who was she, and why are we talking about her today? Well, the bare facts are that she was born in Russian Poland of a Jewish family, born in 1870. Poland at the time was partitioned, and from 1795, a partition between Austria, Germany, and Russia. Now, Rosa graduated at 17 from high school, and as a teenager had already been active in an early Polish socialist organisation. She went to Zurich in 1889 to further her studies. This wasn't possible for a woman in Poland, but in Switzerland, women were at universities on an equal footing. There were many émigrés in Switzerland, particularly from Russia and from Poland, and Rosa went there prepared to take part in émigré socialism. Already from her time in Switzerland, there are signs of what she was to achieve. Her theoretical assertiveness and political independence were already apparent. She was outspoken, fearless, an energetic campaigner, and a prolific writer. Her views on nationalism were a lifelong occupation. This is illustrated by her attitude to the Polish socialist organisations. There was a congress in 1892 of all Polish socialists in the exile was held, but it wasn't possible to have one organisation because of the borders. But in 1892, the new party, the PPS, the Polish Socialist Party, was formed, which covered only the Russian part of Poland. The main goal was the independence for Poland. Therefore, it appealed to all classes, economically oppressed by the bourgeoisie and politically oppressed by Tsardom. And for 10 years, there was an association of Polish socialists abroad, which was in London, to coordinate the activities in all the three territories of the PPS. But Rosa opposed the nationalist aims, and with Jagiś, who was a political and personal relationship over a number of years, they founded the Social Democratic Kingdom of Poland Party, the SDKP, which later merged with the Lithuanian Social Democrats. Now, they called for a common struggle by Polish and Russian workers and ignored the fight for Polish sovereignty. In fact, they saw Polish independence as a utopian mirage, a delusion of the workers to distract them from the class struggle. They produced a publication, and this seems to be a mark of the number of publications that were started. The Workers' Cause. The first issue was in July 1893. Its accent was on the struggle against capitalism, solidarity with Russian working class in the struggle against Russian absolutism, and the international character of all working class movements. There was nothing on independence. The purpose of the publication was to lend weight to a claim for a main mandate at the 1893 Congress of the Second International, which was held in Zurich. There, Rosa made her first public appearance, a speech. The speech was well received, but she, in fact, failed to get a mandate for the organisation there. The organisation later became a separate party. The PPS, the Polish Socialist Party, pointed to Rosa's Jewish origin as inevitably blinding her to the real needs and wishes of the Polish nation. The SDKP was very small because it strove for the unity of Russian and Polish workers, never became very popular in Poland. And Nittel says it was practically a head without a body. But Rosa succeeded in getting a mandate at the next International Congress, which was in London in 1896. She also had two additional German mandates just to be on the safe side. By that Congress, her abilities were being recognised, but she was also being criticised, seen by many leaders in the international as a quarrelsome young woman. And Victor Adler, the leader of the Austrian delegation, wrote that she was a doctrinaire goose. So we see Rosa starting as she means to go on, with strongly held views and intentions to make them known. Writing and speaking, and her first pamphlet, I think that was in 1896, was a cohesive statement on nationalism. Kautsky published her articles in the New Zeit because of their high standard and closely reasoned arguments, but he also answered them in the publication, asserting the revolutionary anti-Tsarist potential of the fight for independence, and warned that opposition to this view would be of assistance to the Russian autocracy. Her activities and articles in the New Zeit caused a storm, and a storm that was also felt at that London Congress. Rosa had produced a resolution with the aim of national independence specifically denied. There was, interestingly enough, a compromise resolution moved by George Lansbury, and that supported the right to self-determination of all nations and sympathising with the workers of all countries suffering under the yoke of different kinds of despotism. Also inviting workers of all countries, of all those countries, to enter the ranks of the class-conscious workers of the whole world to fight with them to overthrow international capitalism. So then we move on to Berlin. Rosa moved there in 1898, and by that time she was fluent in German. She undertook a marriage of convenience simply to get German citizenship. 10 days after she arrived, she joined the SPD, the German Social Democratic Party. I want to say something about the SPD, the largest social democratic party in Europe. It had adopted the Erfurt Programme in 1891, which had an analysis of the present system, but the minimum and maximum programmes. The maximum programme, well, the conversion of capitalistic property into social property, emancipation not just of the proletariat, but of the entire human race, can only be the work of the labouring class. And it was for the abolition of class rule. And interestingly, in view of later happenings, the SDP of Germany declares itself at one with the class-conscious workers of all lands. Then, on the other hand, of course, there's the minimum programme, the present tactic, the struggles in the present society for more immediate objectives, the need to protect working class in the present. It was a mass party. When the anti-socialist laws came to an end in 1890, it polled 1.5 million votes and had 35 seats in the Reichstag, making it the strongest single party. Nettle describes it as being a state within a state, and James Joel said it was a society within a state, embracing the whole life of its members. It had a women's movement, and Joel wrongly states that Rosa Luxemburg was among its most intrepid leaders. In fact, she indignantly refuted the suggestion that, like Clara Zetkin, she might find a natural habitat in the women's movement. The SDP had a range of publications, daily, weekly, monthly, with the New Zeit being their theoretical journal. They even made subsidies to periodicals in foreign countries, in Holland and Belgium, for example. And they had a close relationship with the trade union movement, not formal, as in this country with the Labour Party. The members of the free trade unions, specifically socialist ones, voted Social Democrat, and their leaders played part in the council, in the party councils. So then we come on to revisionism. Rosa Luxemburg got involved in the revisionist dispute immediately upon her arrival, and she saw her response as a way to getting recognition in the SDP. Now, Bernstein, who was responsible for the revisionist views, not for the actions, but for the particular publication, he was a close friend of the leadership of the SPD and a prominent socialist theorist. He was living in London at the time, but he published a series of articles in the New Zeit and then in a book, Evolutionary Socialism. It wasn't a demand for a radical change of policy, but only taking note of what the SPD was already doing. The party just needed to dare to appear as what it was, a democratic party of reform. Capitalism, he said, had a greater potential for survival than Marx had realised. Bernstein emphasised the moral content of socialism, its importance as a means of redistributing income and opportunity. He was concerned to bring practice and theory more into line with reality. Rosa Luxemburg produced a comprehensive criticism, taking on Bernstein for his view, his justification for his view by way of changes that had taken place in capitalism that she refuted. She was not opposed to having a minimum programme. Social democracy was not opposed to reforms, but she saw an indissoluble tie between the social reforms and revolution. The struggle for reforms is its means, the social revolution its aim. But, she said, Bernstein was putting the two factors in opposition to each other. His theory was to renounce the final goal, the social transformation, and make social reforms, what she saw as the means of the class struggle, its aim. Bernstein said that the trade unions and social reforms and the political democratisation of the state are the means of the progressive realisation of socialism. But Rosa Luxemburg said on the role of the trade unions that the role was limited to the struggle over wages and labour time. They cannot suppress exploitation. And she said that either social transformation is the consequence of the internal contradictions of capitalism with its growth, its inner contradictions, resulting inevitably in its collapse. Or Bernstein is right, and capitalism, by means of adaptation, can maintain itself by suppressing its own contradictions. In that case, she said, socialism ceases to be a historic necessity. This idea of capitalism collapsing, of course, went on being accepted for a long time. And I dug out the penny pamphlet that was produced in 1832, refuting the idea that capitalism would collapse. There were party conferences in 1901, 1903, because the discussion on this went on for some time. And in 1904, and make a note of the date, at the Amsterdam Congress, resolutions were adopted condemning the theoretical basis of revisionism. The revisionists stayed in the SPD, and Bernstein was also able to vote for the resolution, even though he hadn't changed his views. But of course, the policy of the party wasn't affected at all. And incidentally, in 1903, they got 3 million votes and had 81 seats in the Reichstag. Now, Rosa saw her response to Bernstein, she said, a scientifically and rigorous rebuttal as a way of getting recognition in the party, as a position of a recognised Marxist in the SPD. And her replies were published first in September 1898 and in the following April, and of course in the pamphlet Reform or Revolution. It was hailed as a work of impeccable scholarship. The 17-member press commission of the SPD elected her editor-in-chief of the Sachsische Arbeiter Zeitung. It didn't last, she resigned in the November. But she was now generally considered one of the top experts of the younger generation on scientific socialism. She was ambitious, she was an outsider, and therefore, as she put it, had no backstairs influence. All deals, she said, are struck backstage, but within a year or two, the intrigues, fears, venom won't matter, because she intended to occupy a position at the top of the party. She was after the most influential position in the party and was ready to fight for it. And as her biographer puts it, and fight she did. She wasn't pleased with what she found in the party. Needed a steady influx of young talent to counter the routine complacency and the growing conservatism. Her criticisms were open and provocative, and some thought showed typical arrogance. She encountered difficulties which were variously attributed to her Jewish origin, her Polish provenance, her gender and her aggressiveness. But as Entinger concludes, she simply was not a good team player. But the elders in the party, William Leibniz, Babel, Kautsky, recognised that she was a unique asset to the party. That's in case anyone was asleep. Recognised that she was a unique asset to the party, hence her rise to the top echelons. Major SPD journals were vying for her contributions, and fees were modest, but for the first time in her life, she was earning money. Jogish, her partner, who was not in Germany at the time, but he was contributing 100 marks a month. In 1903, she became a member of the International Socialist Bureau and was becoming recognised as an expert on Russian and Polish affairs for the international as a whole. In 1907, she was appointed a chair in political economy in the SPD party school, the only woman there. The school was for the education of the party and TU activists. Then we come on to 1905 and the effect of the Russian Revolution on her and on Germany. There was a wave of strikes in Germany which reached a new peak in 1905, not specifically caused by Russian events. Nettle says that the SDP moved left, willing to talk about positive action and to work out tactics. There were a lot of meetings held all over Germany and collections taken as a practical means of backing. The party focused on suffrage reform. There was interaction between the political and economic dissatisfaction, which Rosa later saw as being a feature of a revolutionary period. The idea of the general strike as a means of revolution were discussed in the theoretical journal in New Zeit. Other party publications like Vorwärts were more cautious, but Russian articles were prominent. There was even anarchist speakers on provincial socialist platforms. The executive in the party was described as having cautious preoccupation with the mass strike, but Rosa took this as proof of official legitimacy. And incidentally, 1905 was not an election year. But this small left-wing group with Rosa Luxemburg in the leadership of the group hammered home the German as well as the Russian president. But Rosa travelled all over the country making speeches, attending meetings and discussions, whilst also experiencing an overload of literary and organisational work for the Polish revolutionary movement. And she worked for both for the SDKB and for the SDP, but keeping the thing sort of separate. The SDP party conference in June, Jena, in September 1905, passed a resolution presented by Rosa on the political mass strike and social democracy. Now, Babel made a long speech, but he recommended the mass strike as a defensive weapon. But in this new revolutionary atmosphere, the revisionists, defeat was completed by a purge of the Verworts editors. Rosa was appointed as one of the new editors and made the most of it. Up to 1910, there was wide discretion given to individual party speakers and journalists to interpret party policy. After that time, there was greater attention had to be given to the official line. But in the November and December, Rosa blazed out fiery comments on Russian events, drawing an analogy with Germany as much as she could. Attention of the government was drawn to her. And the right-wing parties in the Reichstag were calling for action against this homeless agitator, a purveyor of hate. Babel, as a leader in the party, had to defend her there, at least against the class enemy, as her friend. There was a difference in attitude between the constituency parties and the unions, and even revisionists like Bernstein, who saw a strike purely as a deterrent, were involved in the discussion. But the trade union leaders was a different matter. They'd made attempts to stop the strike in the Ruhr and did their best to stop it spreading. But the union leaders certainly took fright at strikes for political reasons to do with Prussian suffrage. At the TU Congress in May of 1905, they were on the offensive with speech after speech critical of strikes. The consensus was general strikes are general nonsense. They identified Rosa Luxemburg as the main enemy. She downgraded their splendid work. She was a foreigner, a woman, and was going about the country preaching revolution. Revisionists joined in with a jibe about an imitation Joan of Arc, and an article by the miners' leader in the Union paper said, why didn't these general strike class war theoreticians go to Russia? The liberal press joined in, calling her Bloody Rosa, with jibes but also about why she wasn't off to Warsaw, which of course was in Russian Poland. By the February of the next year, 1906, the SDP leadership had had enough of revolution. They made secret agreement with the trade union leaders that they should have autonomy in all trade union questions, and only with their consent could political policy be forced on them. And in fact, they lost seats in the 1906 election. So the effect of the events in Russia, the 1905 in St. Petersburg, the bloody massacre and strikes that followed, had a profound effect in Russian Poland, resembling there more a national insurrection rather than an economic struggle. They were as much for freedom as for higher wages. Hatred of Russian domination united the workers, intellectuals, students and peasants. And there was a massive strike in October on the heels of a general strike in Russia. The Russians made promises on the constitution and civil liberties, but they weren't kept. There was a short-lived spell of illusory freedom that blunted the pent-up anger. There was also a harsh winter and hunger for strikers' families. You know, the workers were exhausted. There were also, of course, the repressive and punitive measures. So the number of strikes were down in 1906. But when Rosa arrived there, as indeed she did go to Warsaw, at the end of the December under an assumed name, the possibility of a general strike had receded and never took place, though she had hopes that it might. But she was busy with articles, pamphlets, proclamations. She was there illegally, as was Jurgis, and they were both arrested. And because there were problems getting stuff printed and so on when you're working illegally. The leadership of the SDP made every effort to get her free and probably paid a bribe to get her, or supplied the money for the bribe to get her bail. She was ill and eventually was allowed to leave the country. On the way back to Germany, she stopped in Finland, and there she had discussions with one Lenin. There she wrote The Mass Strike, The Political Party and the Trade Unions, another of her more famous works. And one thing she said in it is, if the Russian Revolution teaches us anything, it is above all that a mass strike cannot be artificially produced, decided at random or propagated, but that it is a historical phenomenon that at the right time results from social conditions with historical inevitability. When I read about her a lot of years ago, I had the impression that whenever there was a strike taking place in places, she would go and to try and sort of fit that into her theories. Until the war in 1914, her stature was growing, her fame spreading, even as far as the US. The position in the party school enhanced her prestige. She now had the student admirers as well, and she also produced articles and lesson material for the school. Her journalism had a wide readership, and there were enthusiastic audiences for her speeches. She had friends, comrades, and appeared to have a rich social life. But Attinger says that it was an illusion. She had sleepless nights and depression. Her home was in Germany, but she was an outsider and didn't seem to belong anywhere. And she had a sheer number of battles between 1910 and 13, which are an indication of her mood. Attinger lists Kautsky, Babel, Lenin, German social democracy, and Polish nationalists. Each group or individual that crossed her were dealt with ruthlessly and sometimes viciously. And Kautsky, for example, he refused to publish an article on the mass strike called What Next, unless she deleted a passage urging the establishment of a republic in Germany. The articles were also turned down by Verwoerts. This led to having difficulty in getting things published anywhere. And so in 1912, five out of her nine articles appeared in Clara Zetkin's publication called Equality. Otherwise, she seldom wrote for that publication. She was repelled by the German socialist leaders. They were unwilling to exchange comfortable homes for the barricades. Nettle says that the executive were not interested in revolution, but in the status quo. They needed a strict separation between theory and practice. As time went on, the ideology of revolution was serving as a means of social cohesion within the party, but practical policies were being applied at all levels, taking part in elections, trade union activity, and attempts to form blocs with bourgeois parties in the Reichstag. So the gulf between theory and practice widened. Some indication of how these things were being affected. In 1906, as I said, they lost nearly half their seats. But in the Reichstag, in the next year, where the Chancellor attacked Social Democrats as traitors, the SPD lost 38 seats. But by the end of 1909, the anti-socialist front in German politics was breaking up. And in 1912, the vote was up. The votes, and I've left a gap here for the number of votes that they had that I haven't filled in. But they got 112 deputies to the Reichstag. And here's a quote from Babel here. He says, "The heart of the people turns towards us because we take up the cause of their daily need." in September of 1913, Rosa Luxemburg gave a speech urging German workers not to take up arms against workers of other nationalities. And she was sentenced to a year in prison for inciting public disobedience. The appeal took several months, so in the meantime, she could make many speeches, including one accusing the military of mistreating soldiers. And there was a celebrity trial for this, but in fact, over 1,000 victims of abuse came forward to testify for the defence, and that contributed to it being quietly dropped. But celebrity bred hostility. The Conservatives offended. The Conservatives were offended that the authorities tolerated activities of this scandalous female, speaking of the future German Republic. She didn't begin her sentence until February of 1915, and 5 months after the end of the sentence was again into custody without evidence, but it was described as protective custody for the rest of the war. So she was able to carry on making speeches against the impending war. She had faith in the international solidarity of workers and was firm in the moral strength and authority of the international. And Ettinger cites the resolution on war passed at the Congress held in Stuttgart in 1907. It was jointly amended by Luxembourg and Lenin, stipulating that in case of war, the working class was duty-bound to rouse the people and thereby hasten the abolition of the capitalist rule. She was convinced that a general strike on an international scale could prevent war. In spite of the view of the strength of the SDP by European socialists, it was increasingly placing its achievements and influence at the service of the government. And, of course, the Second International came to an end when French, German and Austrian socialists voted for war appropriations. In 1914, there was a declaration in a Swiss newspaper by Clara Zetkin, Franz Mehring, Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht disclaiming their allegiance to the official party line. A word or so now, she was in prison, as I've already said, in February 1915. So a publication that she wrote against the war, it was known as the Junius pamphlet, was written in prison in early 1915 and smuggled out and published in Zurich. In it she said that the SDP didn't have the wrong policy, they didn't have a policy. The Reichstag group had claimed that they'd voted only the means of the country's defence and declined all responsibility for the war. But Rosa Luxemburg said the opposite was true and defined national defence as the means for imperialistic mass butchery by the armed forces of the military monarchy. The availability of war credits did not depend upon them, as there was a majority of the capitalist Reichstag. But by their vote, they sustained the fictions that were propagated by the government concerning the actual conditions and problems of the war. And she asked if the masses would have supported the party in an attitude against the war. But she said, well, it's not the point. Parliament didn't demand assurance of victory before voting war credits. But the German proletariat, if they had opposed the war, the German proletariat would have remained the lighthouse keeper of the whole international and of human emancipation. In that publication, she dismisses the possibility of a general strike. Mass movements are not made by technical recipes that repose in the pockets of leaders. For the European proletariat as a class, victory or For the European proletariat as a class, victory or defeat of either of the two war groups would be equally disastrous. For the class-conscious proletariat to identify with either military camp is an untenable position. But she still advocated working within the SPD for as long as possible and in order to keep in touch with the masses. She underestimated, of course, the nationalism people. Then comes what she saw as the most significant event of the war, the Russian Revolution of 1917. Now, Rosa had written an article in the summer of 1918, but was persuaded not to publish because public criticism of the beleaguered and fragile regime was not in the interest of the revolution. So she started a longer work which was not published on her release from prison and not published in her lifetime. She'd previously had disagreements with Lenin, for one thing on self-determination of nations, and in a 1904 article in New Zeit, she criticised Lenin's theory of organisation. The ultra-centralism that Lenin advocates seems to us in its whole essence to be imbued not with a positive creative spirit, but with the sterile spirit of the night watchman state. And the night watchman, that means an autocratic state. Lenin says bureaucratism versus democratism is the organisational principle of revolutionary social democracy versus the organisational principle of the opportunist. And he gives the example of the local autonomy of electoral districts, which was argued for by revisionists in the SPD against excessive centralism as a way to promote reformist policies. Though I don't know why they would have done that when the party went in for reformist policies anyway. But on the Russian Revolution, she is critical of the loss of democracy. The elimination of democracy is worse than the disease it is supposed to cure. In place of the representative bodies created by general popular elections, Lenin and Trotsky have laid down the Soviets as the only true representation of the labouring masses. But with the repression of political life in the land as a whole, life in the Soviets must also become more and more crippled. Without general elections, without unrestricted freedom of press and assembly, without a free struggle of opinion, life dies out in every public institution, becomes a mere semblance of life in which only the bureaucracy remains as the active element. Public life gradually falls asleep. A few dozen party leaders of inexhaustible energy and boundless experience direct and rule. Among them, in reality, only a dozen outstanding heads do the leading. An elite of the working class is invited from time to time to meetings where they can applaud the speeches of the leaders and approve resolutions unanimously. A dictatorship, to be sure, not the dictatorship of the proletariat, however, but only the dictatorship of a handful of politicians. And the dictatorship in the bourgeois sense, she would go further. But she also excused the Bolsheviks, who no doubt, she said, would have proceeded in a different way were it not for the conditions of war and occupation. A crude proof of this is provided by the use of terror to so wide an extent in the most recent period. And she says it is an inadequate commonplace that revolutions are not pink teas. So Rosa knew both Lenin and Trotsky and had discussed the prospects for revolution in Russia with them. She thinking that they had, like Lenin, that there had to be two distinct stages. But she says that they were ahead as an example to the proletariat of the world. They have advanced mightily the settlement of the score between capital and labour in the entire world. And as I said, she had discussed this, that the proletarian revolution would need two distinct stages, the bourgeois revolution first and then later the proletarian revolution. But Jarosz says that this concept was confounded in 1917. So we move on to Germany in 1918. In January, there was a mass strike for peace involving 1 million workers, the mutiny of sailors in Kiel. In October, the German front collapsed, and defeated in the war, Kaiser was forced to abdicate. And what was now called the Spartacus Group called on people, I think I missed that out, called on people to rise to create conditions of freedom for the class struggle of the workers, for a real democracy, for a real and lasting peace, and for socialism. From the beginning of November, there were soldiers' councils appeared at the front, and workers' councils sprang up in most major cities. Nettle comments that they were demonstrations of revolt rather than instruments of revolution. Mostly they had no clear programme, only claiming the right to exist. Some of them supported some of the councils supported the government. Ebert, for the Social Democrat leader, was made chancellor, and the party ruled along the lines of a Labour Party. The Social Democrats were no longer blaming the capitalist system for problems, as they had before the war, but now were blaming individuals. Lessons about the class conflict were thrown to the winds, but the old words still served. There were strikes and disruption with people out on the streets. The armistice terms allowed troops back, and with the aid of army officers from the old regime, the Ebert-Scheidemann government was easily able to crush the revolt. And Rosa Luxemburg and Kohl Leibniz were murdered by members of the Freikorps, and others were killed. The 2 months between her release from prison and her murder on January the 15th were among the most important and creative of her life. And among the writings was "What Does the Spartacus League Want?" In it we find "Down with the wages system. The means of production should cease to be the monopoly of a single class, must become the common property of all. This transformation cannot be decreed by bureau or parliament, only by the masses themselves," and it repeats the need for proletarian mass action. "Must replace the inherited organs of class rule with its own class workers' and soldiers' councils." She says the proletarian revolution needs no killing, but it would be insanity to think that capitalists would obey the verdict of a parliament or National Assembly, would renounce property, profit, the right to exploit. It needs the million-headed proletarian mass to seize the entire power of the state in its calloused fist. Like the god Thor, his hammer, using it to smash the head of the ruling classes, that alone is democracy. There is a list of demands: immediate measures to protect the revolution, and economic demands, the confiscation of all dynastic wealth, expropriation of all banks, mines, smelters, and all large enterprises of industry and commerce, and more besides. So now I want to refer to the speech that Rosa Luxemburg made at the founding of the German Communist Party in December the 31st of 1918, with Karl Liebknecht and Rosa amongst the major leaders. In it, she refers to the Communist Manifesto, which dealt with the realization of the ultimate goal of socialism as the immediate task of the proletarian revolution. She then refers to Marx and Engels' joint preface to the 1872 edition, in which they say that in view of the strides of modern industry, no special stress would be laid on the revolutionary measures proposed at the end of section 2, and she reproduces the list. Then goes on to say that further development of capital means that what was incorrect in 1872 has become truth today. Our immediate task is to fulfil what Marx and Engels thought they would have to accomplish in 1848. In other words, it's a recipe for state capitalism. And incidentally, because Marx said in 1881 that Rosa obviously wouldn't have known about, in reply to a correspondent, that he didn't think the socialist movement would come to power in any country unless at the same time it was in a position to overcome any capitalist resistance. And he said, if you're thinking about the Commune in Paris, that was merely the rising of a city under exceptional circumstance, was in no wise socialist, and nor could it have been, though he did say with a modicum of common sense they might have managed a better ending. So then Luxemburg moves on to Engels' preface to the 1895 edition of Marx's class struggles in France, but she only knew the version that had been edited by the Social Democratic Party. And she says that Engels appends a detailed critique of the illusion that under modern capitalist conditions, the proletariat could possibly gain anything by street fighting. She said this was at the behest of the SDP, Babel and comrades to save German labour movement from anarchist deviations. And she cites that preface as being the proclamation of the parliamentarism-only tactic. And the parliamentary struggle was supposed to direct revolutionary action by the proletariat. Also meant that the entire mass of proletarians in uniform were immune, absolutely inaccessible to socialist influence. Well, there's 2 points here, or well, three if we include parliamentarism. What, of course, she did not know was that Engels had in fact protested about the delations, but he died in the year of the preface, 1895. However, even in the full version, where he's certainly not ruling out street fighting, though he says more seldom at the beginning of a great revolution than in its further progress, but he still warned about the strength of the military and said it would be madness to choosing barricade to fight in the working class portions of the of districts of Berlin. And incidentally, and in light of what happened to Rosa, he did say that already in 1849, the spell of the barricades was broken. The soldier no longer saw behind it the people, but rebels, agitators, scum, and so on. In a piece published on November the 18th, Rosa had said that soldiers who had been murdering revolutionary proletarians in Finland, Russia, and the Ukraine, and workers who allowed this to happen have not become in 24-hour supporters of socialism. And sadly for her, they hadn't. In the final article written by Rosa, she said, could the Ebert-Scheidemann government have been removed? Could a revolutionary dictatorship have been established? No. If the rightness of the German proletariat is taken into account, the permanent victory in this context was not yet possible. The revolt had been necessary and had been provoked by the government. So let's have a look at now, coming to conclusion, as points where we would agree with her. Opposition to capitalism, of course, the importance of democracy as being integral to socialism, opposition to nationalism. The means of production should cease to be the monopoly of a single class, must become the common property of all, and the need for the involvement of the mass of people. Disagree that revolution has to involve strikes and street violence, getting people onto the street, that the Russian Revolution had anything to do with getting socialism, disagreeing that the aim has to be for state capitalism. Now, I mentioned attention to 1904. Well, that was when this party was formed, of course. And from the outset, had but one aim, seeing the mistakes as what had already happened, the aim to be for socialism, but nothing but. No minimum programme. The issue has to be kept clear. And on the parliamentarism dilemma, Parliament has only been seen in connection with reforms. And of course, the problem about socialism and around the turn of the century and so on, socialism was sort of on the agenda, but there was this problem about how to get it. And this is why this talk of whether it should be, you know, the strikes or quite how you are going to get it, and the idea, the vanguard idea of a minority leading the workers who found out what it was all about in the course of the struggle. But in our view, the Parliament can be used. It doesn't have to be a reformist thing. What we do to ensure a peaceful change, we use the electoral system to send delegates to Parliament with but one aim. And this is a positive action There has to be political organisation, people from every sphere already understanding and preparing for the change. This is a revolution by the majority. The capitalist class would lose their privileged position, but otherwise they can join in with everyone else and we're not thinking of doing anything very harmful to them. But the idea is using Parliament, which is the seat of government, and there you have the control of the armed forces so that they can't be used against the revolution. But just that one aim, and lopping off all the coercive elements and making use of any elements that can be used. This can't happen without majority understanding, so we go along with Engels in that preface. For a transformation in the social organisation, the masses themselves must already have grasped what is at stake. I personally wouldn't use the term masses. It doesn't sound quite right. I prefer working class, which involves 90% or so of the population. Also, there are no leaders in the party. One of the things with the Social Democratic Party was that the executive were able to make decisions. And also, only those accepting the object and means to obtain it are accepted as members. I just got one little note here that what Rosa said about the bourgeois parliamentarism, that it's a breeding ground for the opportunist current in social democratic movement in Western Europe, the springboard for political careerism. On the damage done by socialists to the cause of socialism, the two programmes, the minimum and the maximum programme, in the same organisations, so that the minimum programme came to be called socialism. This is what happened with the Labour Party, that was never a socialist party, but getting the minimum aims back came to be called socialism. And, of course, the Russian Revolution being called socialist was also a harm done to the cause of socialism. But I'll end just with a line from Rosa, who said that the need for socialism is a historical necessity.